They call it paradise. But behind the palm trees and carnival paint lies another reality, one soaked in blood, betrayal, and broken promises. In Trinidad and Tobago, a child's laughter can be silenced by a single shot. The police are feared, the state is absent, and the funeral home knows your name before your teacher does. This isn't fiction. This is a nation at war with itself. From gang wars in Beetham Gardens to the forgotten mothers of Laventil, this audiobook is not just a story, it's a reckoning. Caribbean history isn't only about freedom and music. Sometimes it's about survival. This is Trinidad's bloody paradise. And what you hear may change everything you thought you knew about the Caribbean. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. They call it paradise. But just beyond the emerald hills and sunlit coastlines, the sound of gunfire splits the humid Caribbean air. In one part of Trinidad, luxury SUVs idle in gated communities under blooming poi trees. In another, boys no older than 14 cradle AR-15s, sworn to codes of silence, loyalty, and blood. This is the true story of an island split in two. Not by geography, but by fate. We begin in Port of Spain, the heartbeat of Trinidad. Bustling, congested, alive. On one side, Merivale and West Moorings, modern enclaves of wealth where diplomats and oil executives sip imported wine under guarded terraces. On the other, Laventil, Beetham Gardens, and Sea Lots, neighborhoods where poverty walks with a loaded weapon and tomorrow is never promised. But how did we get here? How did a land once hailed as a Caribbean economic miracle become one of the region's most violent nations? To understand the present, we must go back. Back to 1956, when a charismatic figure named Dr. Eric Williams, the father of the nation, led Trinidad and Tobago toward independence from British rule. His people's national movement promised self-governance, unity, and prosperity. And for a while, it seemed possible. By the 1970s, thanks to oil exports, Trinidad's economy boomed. The government built schools, hospitals, and homes. But beneath the surface, fault lines were forming. The wealth never trickled down evenly. The inner cities, especially in East Port of Spain, remained neglected. Poor infrastructure, overcrowded housing, and limited opportunity bred frustration. The 1990s saw the rise of urban gangs, not unlike those in Los Angeles or Rio de Janeiro. What began as turf wars among small cliques evolved into sophisticated criminal enterprises, often with ties to international narcotics trafficking. With Venezuela just a few nautical miles away, Trinidad became a transit hub for drugs and guns, a dangerous honor with deadly consequences. Laventil, perched on a hillside just outside the city, became one of the most feared and misunderstood places in the country. Locals call it a garrison, and in many ways it is. Police rarely patrol the narrow alleys, and when they do, gun battles often follow. Children grow up knowing which walls to crouch behind during shootouts and which corners belong to which soldiers. We spoke to 28-year-old Akil Asterisk, a former gang affiliate from Beetham Gardens, now trying to escape that life. We don't have no prime minister in here. We don't have no law. Our government is the man with the most bullets. You call police, and by the time they reach, you're dead already. For Akil and many like him, violence isn't a choice, it's a condition. One born from economic starvation, educational collapse, and a system that forgot them long ago. But what about the state? In 2005, the government declared a national war on gangs. Anti-gang acts were passed. The Special Anti-Crime Unit of Trinidad and Tobago, SOT, was formed. Tactical raids, detentions, surveillance, all in the name of national security. But for every arrest, another retaliation. For every community meeting, another drive-by. And behind it all, whispers of corruption. In 2011, several senior officers were suspended for leaking information to gang leaders. Trust in the police plummeted. In some communities, people fear law enforcement more than criminals. According to 2023 crime statistics, Trinidad recorded over 610 murders, with 85% involving firearms. The majority occurred in the capital and surrounding urban zones. The murder rate was over 40 per 100,000 people, one of the highest in the Western Hemisphere. Compare that to Canada's 2.1 or the UK's 1.2, and the magnitude becomes clear. But the violence is not only about drugs or territory. It's about identity. In communities where the state has failed, the gang becomes a family. The gun becomes power. The trigger becomes validation. Cultural anthropologist Dr. Patrice Henry, who has studied Trinidad's inner-city communities for 2 decades, explains, "These are not simply criminals. These are disenfranchised youths who are performing what they've been taught, dominance, fear, and respect. In a society that neglects them, the gang becomes their nation." Even language reflects this split. In the middle-class suburbs, children speak of school, ballet, and summer trips. In the ghettos, they speak of blocks, ends, licks, and ops. 2 nations, 1 flag. Yet, amidst the darkness, there are flickers of light. Community centers like Serval, Vision on Mission, and grassroots football and music programs have offered alternatives. Steel band orchestras still echo from hillside panyards. Artists like Bungie Garland and Destra speak of unity and pride. But even these voices sometimes drown beneath the echo of gunfire. The tragedy of Trinidad is not just its crime, but its potential. This is a country of cultural brilliance, economic possibility, and intellectual firepower. But it remains shackled by an internal war that has never been officially declared. This chapter ends not with a conclusion, but with a question. Can a nation love carnival and still bury hundreds of young men each year? Can music and murder coexist? Can peace come to a place where children learn to duck bullets before they learn to read? In the next chapter, we go deeper into the guns themselves, where they come from, how they get here, and why the island has become a battlefield where everyone is armed, but few are truly protected. Welcome to Trinidad's Bloody Paradise, where beauty and brutality walk the same street. It begins not with a gunshot, but with silence. The silence of a customs officer turning away from a suspicious crate. The silence of a politician shaking hands in the shadows. The silence of a mother pretending not to see the shape under her son's mattress. In Trinidad and Tobago, silence has become the deadliest accomplice in a gun culture that began decades ago, and now thrives in the shadows of every street corner, every squatter camp, every port, and every promise. To understand the bloodshed, we must first trace the journey of the gun, the geography of a trafficker's dream. Trinidad sits in a precarious position, just 11 kilometers from the Venezuelan coastline. To the north lies the Caribbean Sea. To the south, South America. To the west, the shipping routes to the US and Europe. Its location makes it a natural transshipment hub. And where drugs pass, guns follow. Beginning in the late 1980s, cocaine smuggling through South America intensified. As Colombia, Venezuela, and Brazil became hotspots for drug exports, Trinidad's porous maritime borders offered traffickers a quiet corridor. They brought cocaine in. They took guns out. But as Trinidad became more than just a waypoint, as gangs matured and local markets grew violent, those guns stayed. How the guns arrive? Guns in Trinidad are not made locally. Yet they appear in thousands, on rooftops, under floorboards, in backpacks slung over shoulders of teenagers. So where do they come from? According to official TPS and ANAG reports, illegal firearms in Trinidad arrive through 3 primary channels. 1. Seaports and container smuggling. The majority of illegal weapons are smuggled through legitimate shipping containers. Firearms are disassembled and hidden inside appliances, machinery, even food packaging. With understaffed port security and alleged insider corruption, inspections are inconsistent at best. A leaked report in 2021 revealed that less than 8% of all containers are properly scanned upon arrival. 2. Private fishing boats and pirogues. The Gulf of Paria is a lawless stretch of sea. At night, small pirogues, wooden boats used by fishermen, cross between Venezuela and Trinidad with ease. Hidden in fish crates or false hulls, AK-47s, Glock pistols, and Tech-9s find their way to quiet coves and mangrove hideouts. Many are traded for food, fuel, or drugs with desperate Venezuelans fleeing economic collapse. 3. Postal services and barrel trade. Illegal gun parts are sometimes shipped piece by piece through barrels, large shipping drums used by diaspora families to send goods from the US, Canada, and the UK. These parts are then reassembled locally by skilled gun techs, sometimes inside auto garages or backyard workshops. The rise of ghost guns and modified weapons. In recent years, police have seized not just imported firearms, but homemade or modified weapons, known as ghost guns. These include pistols with 3D printed components, converted flare guns or starter pistols, shotguns made from pipes and wood, fully automatic handguns modified with illegal conversion kits. These weapons bear no serial numbers and are virtually untraceable. The business of blood. Behind every gun lies a profit chain. An imported Glock 17 that costs $500 in the US can sell for 25,000 Trinidad and Tobago dollars to 40,000 Trinidad and Tobago dollars on the Trinidad black market, more than most families earn in a year. Young men in gangs see firearms as a path to instant status, protection, and power. A gun doesn't just give you leverage in a dispute. It gives you value in a system where life is cheap, but pride is priceless. And with every gun that enters the island, the economy of death expands. Rent-a-gun services, one weapon passed between five different youths in a week, each paying for a night's control. Gun-for-hire hit squads. Homicides executed for fees ranging from 5,000 Trinidad and Tobago dollars to 30,000 Trinidad and Tobago dollars. Protection rackets. Businesses forced to pay weekly fees or face the barrel. Political muscle. Gangs used to intimidate or protect candidates during elections. The police and the paradox. The Trinidad and Tobago Police Service is well aware of the gun crisis. Weekly seizures are announced with fanfare. Photos of assault rifles, pistols, and ammunition spread across media headlines. But for every gun seized, two more arrive. Even more disturbing, some officers are complicit. In 2019, two senior officers were arrested for facilitating gun licenses in exchange for bribes. Others have been implicated in gun running investigations. It is not uncommon for seized weapons to reappear on the streets months later, as though the evidence room were a revolving door. The psychological toll. Living in a society where every youth might be armed, paranoia becomes survival. Children walk to school past crime scenes taped off with yellow ribbon. Bus stops carry bullet holes. Mothers teach their sons to play dead if they hear gunshots. Entire communities know the sound of different guns, distinguishing an Uzi from a .38 revolver by ear. A generation is growing up not just in fear, but in familiarity with war. Why it persists? Because guns are not just tools, they are symbols. In a nation where poverty is systemic and justice feels distant, a firearm becomes the last resort of a voiceless people. A boy who owns a gun feels equal, if not superior, to the man who ignored him. And until that changes, the gun will remain not just in his hand, but in his mind. Toward a disarmed future? There have been efforts. The Firearm Amnesty Program in 2013 collected over 1,000 illegal guns. The National Security Ministry launched initiatives with Interpol to trace serial numbers and gun flows. NGOs like Citizens Security Program work with communities to promote disarmament. But without serious reforms in customs oversight, policing integrity, community alternatives, and international collaboration, the tide remains strong. We end this chapter with an image. A schoolboy in Laventille, no older than 12, is interviewed on a radio program. When asked what he wants to be when he grows up, he answers, "Alive." In a country where the wrong block, the wrong word, or the wrong moment can be fatal, the very idea of survival has become a dream. There are places on the map of Trinidad that carry no warning signs, no barbed wire, no borders. But everyone knows, once you cross into the block, you're not in Trinidad anymore. You're in gang territory, where rules are written in blood, loyalty is currency, and silence is survival. In this chapter, we descend into the inner workings of Trinidad's urban ghettos, not just to report the violence, but to understand the invisible architecture of power, fear, and belonging that sustains it. Where the state disappears. Let us begin in Beetham Gardens, a dense sprawl of government housing on the edge of the highway between Port of Spain and the East-West Corridor. Here, the paint peels off the walls like old memories. Sewage lines overflow. Water comes and goes. Electricity flickers. And the sound of gunfire is not a disruption, it's a rhythm. In these neighborhoods, Beetham, Laventille, Sea Lots, Morvant, Enterprise, the state is mostly absent. Garbage trucks don't come on time. Ambulances hesitate to enter. But someone always responds. The local gang leader, known on the streets as Don or Big Man, controls everything from who eats to who dies. When a child is born, he's gifted baby clothes by the crew. When a funeral happens, the gang pays for the casket. When a woman is abused, justice may come not from court, but from a machete in the hands of a lieutenant. In these places, gangs are not just criminal enterprises. They are governments in the vacuum of the real one. the structure of the street kingdom. Despite what outsiders think, most gangs in Trinidad are highly structured, often mirroring corporate or paramilitary chains of command. They include the Don, the highest-ranking leader, often older, charismatic, and rarely seen in public. The Enforcers, heavily armed men who carry out orders, settle disputes, and control territory. The Spotters, young boys and girls who track police or rival movements, acting as eyes and ears. The Runners, transporters of drugs, weapons, and messages, often under 16 to avoid harsh legal penalties. The Shooters, trained or conditioned young men whose sole role is to kill. Many are initiated by making a first hit. There is ritual, hierarchy, and internal discipline. Betrayal is punished swiftly. Disobedience is rare, and often fatal. One former member we interviewed under anonymity, Jason, described his initiation. I was 13. They told me, if you want to eat with us, you have to prove your worth. They gave me a .38. The man I shot, he never even knew my name. But that night, I became a man in their eyes. The currency of fear. Trinidad's ghettos are governed not just by violence, but by fear. Fear ensures silence. Silence ensures survival. Even with hundreds of homicides a year, less than 10% result in convictions. Witnesses vanish. Testimonies evaporate. CCTV mysteriously fails. In some cases, families of witnesses are threatened or murdered. This fear breeds a grim culture of mind your business. If you see something, you didn't. If you hear something, it was probably fireworks. If you know something, take it to your grave. And yet, everyone knows everything. War within the walls. Gang wars in Trinidad are not about ideology or ethnicity. They are about turf, power, and respect. Disputes erupt over drug routes, romantic relationships, accidental disrespect, social media deces, leaked police cooperation. A feud between two men can ignite a blood feud between entire communities. In 2022, a conflict between two crews in Enterprise, Chaguanas, led to 17 murders in a span of 2 months, all within a 3-mile radius. Schools shut down. Buses were diverted. No one was arrested. Prison as headquarters. Ironically, many gangs are still controlled from behind prison walls. The nation's largest correctional facility, Golden Grove Prison, has become an unofficial headquarters for gang strategy. Using smuggled phones, corrupt guards, and coded messages, incarcerated dons orchestrate hits, manage money, and even run drug operations from behind bars. Some inmates intentionally get arrested during turf wars, to seek protection inside or to coordinate from within. The role of music and street culture. Music plays a complex role in this ecosystem. Trinidad's badness culture has produced a wave of local rap, trap, and dancehall artists whose lyrics glorify violence, gang loyalty, and retaliation. Music videos feature real guns, real streets, and often serve as coded threats between rival groups. Yet the same platforms are also used by young artists desperate to escape. Some use music to tell the truth, not to glamorize it, but to mourn it. The question remains, is music reflecting the reality or reinforcing it? The mothers who stay silent. Perhaps the most tragic figures in this story are the mothers. They wash the blood out of school uniforms. They stitch bullet holes into curtains. They bury their sons and never speak of who pulled the trigger, even when they know. Why? Because in these ghettos, talking gets you killed. And in the silence, there is no justice. Only mourning, the system that feeds it. At the core of this code of silence is a system that offers no protection. Police who are underpaid, outgunned, or corrupt. Judges who face threats. Prosecutors afraid to push. Juries too intimidated to convict. In this vacuum, the gang is order. The law is fear. The silence is law. Hope behind the wall. But even here, there are seeds of resistance. Grassroots organizations like Hearts and Minds, Living Water, and Families in Action run mentorship programs, safe spaces, and therapy circles. Some former gang members now work as violence interrupters. Men like Andrew, a former killer who now mediates conflicts before they escalate. I buried more brothers than I can count, but I'm trying to save more than I buried. There are no easy answers, only stories. Of boys who never saw 20. Of girls who carry grief in silence. Of families who sleep with one eye open. In these ghettos, the code of silence is more than a rule. It's a language, a survival mechanism, a scar that runs through the island's soul. A nation is only as strong as the promises it keeps. And Trinidad and Tobago, a land once baptized in the hope of independence, has broken too many of its own. In communities where murder is a weekly ritual and silence is a survival strategy, the most devastating betrayal did not come from gangs, but from the state itself. This chapter confronts the uncomfortable truth that the Caribbean's most violent streets were paved not just by criminals, but by politicians, police, and policymakers who looked away. A legacy of forgotten neighborhoods. It started subtly. After independence in 1962, and especially during the oil boom of the 1970s, Trinidad made bold promises of education for all, healthcare, infrastructure, national development. But as high-rises gleamed in West Moorings and highways curved through newly named suburbs, places like Laventille, Beetham Gardens, and Sea Lots received little more than temporary band-aids. Unfinished community centers, shuttered schools, and handshakes before elections. These ghettos became islands within the island, spoken of in Parliament only when blood stained the headlines. And every time a politician promised to fix things once and for all, the people grew more cynical, because they had seen this movie before. Political complicity and dirty deals. Behind closed doors, politics and crime have danced for decades in Trinidad. In the late 1990s and early 2000s, reports emerged that politicians had formed quiet alliances with gang leaders, offering community grants, housing contracts, and government jobs in exchange for loyalty and peace during elections. This informal arrangement became known on the street as community control. Translation: keep your block quiet during campaign season and your gang eats. Disrupt that peace and lose your access. A 2006 report by the National Security Ministry revealed that millions of dollars were paid out to community-based organizations, CBOs, that had direct links to gang structures. Some of these CBOs existed only on paper. Others were operated by ghost leaders, gang members under false names. Election after election, politicians stood on platforms in crime-ridden neighborhoods, flanked by smiling youth leaders who were in fact well-known criminals. The public saw. The youth learned. Power was not about justice. It was about alignment, the collapse of the justice system. In a functioning democracy, crime is fought in courtrooms, not alleyways. But in Trinidad and Tobago, the justice system has become a graveyard of cases, broken files, and vanished witnesses. The average murder trial can take 5 to 7 years to reach court, if it ever does. Over 90% of murder cases end without conviction. More than 65,000 backlogged criminal cases clog the system. Many of these collapses happen before they begin. Police reports mysteriously disappear. Officers are transferred before testimony. Surveillance footage malfunctions. Key witnesses retract their statements or vanish. Sometimes they're killed. The police and the people, a shattered relationship. The Trinidad and Tobago Police Service, TPS, is tasked with maintaining order, but trust in the force is fractured, especially in communities most affected by crime. According to a 2022 UWI survey, only 21% of respondents fully trust the police. In gang-heavy neighborhoods, the number is even lower. Why? Because while many officers serve honorably, others operate as enforcers, collaborators, or executioners. Stories abound of officers selling firearms seized from raids, leaking information to gangs about rivals or upcoming operations, extrajudicial killings of suspected criminals without trial, planting evidence or demanding bribes in exchange for dropped charges. Worse still, citizens who try to report crimes are often interrogated as suspects or left exposed, with their information leaked. In this system, the line between law and lawlessness has blurred, and in some cases disappeared entirely. Social infrastructure in ruins. When you walk through the streets of Laventille or Enterprise, you won't just see gang graffiti and bullet holes. You'll see schools that haven't opened in years, playgrounds turned into drug corners, libraries turned into storage rooms, healthcare centers that open once a week, if at all. The people were not just abandoned by justice, they were abandoned by investment. In places where young men have no sports fields, no music programs, no tech labs, and no hope of employment, the gang becomes not a seduction, but a certainty, the economy of inequality. On paper, Trinidad and Tobago is one of the richest nations in the Caribbean, thanks to its oil and gas reserves. But dig deeper, and the truth emerges. The wealth is highly concentrated, and inequality is growing. In communities plagued by crime, unemployment among youth ages 16 to 25 is often above 40%. And when jobs are available, many young men are rejected due to their address. Your zip code becomes a prison before you've ever committed a crime. Imagine being 17 years old. No job, no school. But a man from your block offers you 1,000 Trinidad and Tobago dollars to watch a thing. Then 2,000 Trinidad and Tobago dollars to carry something. Then 10,000 Trinidad and Tobago dollars to take care of a man. The government gives you speeches. The gang gives you food, respect, and fear. Who would you choose? Why the state has not fixed this? It's easy to blame bureaucracy, but the truth is more sinister. Fixing crime would mean dismantling a system that has served the powerful. A broken community is easy to manipulate. A fearful population is easier to control. And a violent neighborhood, as long as it stays within its borders, does not threaten the elite. This is not failure. This is design. Cracks in the wall, a growing resistance. But not everyone accepts this fate. Civil society is pushing back. Activists are documenting abuse. Journalists are exposing corruption. Youth leaders are running mentorship programs on scraps of funding. Some brave police officers are cleaning house from within. In 2023, a joint task force arrested 5 senior officers linked to a weapons ring. It was one of the most significant crackdowns in a decade. In the same year, the Youth for Change program in Morvant graduated 112 young men, most of them ex-gang members, in construction, IT, and music production. The state is still broken. But the people, some are starting to build again. This is what happens when a nation breaks its promise. The people stop believing. The systems decay. And hope becomes a weapon wielded only by the desperate. But maybe, just maybe, the story is not finished. War has always left behind 2 types of casualties. Those who fall to the bullets, and those who remain to bury them. In Trinidad and Tobago, amid the nightly gunshots, flashing sirens, and unmarked graves, there is a quieter crisis unfolding. One that doesn't make headlines but bleeds through every home behind the yellow tape. It is the crisis of grief. Of mothers. Of sisters. Of daughters. Of women who have become the forgotten soldiers in a war they never signed up for, but fight every single day. The grieving mother, a common tragedy. Meet Marsha, age 44, from Morvant. She raised 2 sons as a single mother, working nights at a bakery and still finding time to braid their hair, pack lunches, and drill math problems at the kitchen table. Her eldest, Dion, was murdered 3 days after his 17th birthday, caught in the crossfire of a turf war over a street he never claimed. She received no justice, no apology, no name, only a call from the morgue, and a pair of bloodstained sneakers. When your child is killed in this country, she says, you grieve, and then you disappear. You bury them, and you vanish. Because grief, in the ghettos of Trinidad, has no infrastructure. No therapists. No victim support teams. No national counseling hotlines. Just funeral bills, stained clothes, and memories that refuse to fade. Women as victims of direct violence. While much of the violence in Trinidad is driven by male-on-male gang conflict, women are increasingly being targeted, both intentionally and as collateral damage. In 2022 alone, over 70 women were murdered, many as victims of domestic abuse or revenge killings. Gunmen often retaliate by shooting sisters or girlfriends of rivals. In some cases, young women are forced into sexual relationships with gang leaders to protect their families or earn survival. These women live in constant fear, trapped in communities where fleeing means risking death, and speaking out means signing your own death warrant. We don't sleep, says Tasha, a 19-year-old from Beetham Gardens. We wait. The domestic fallout, homes held together by pain. Gun violence doesn't just destroy lives, it unravels households. When a father is killed or imprisoned, mothers become the only providers. When an older brother is murdered, a younger sibling often seeks revenge. The emotional residue of these deaths spreads like mold through the walls. Children developing PTSD before puberty. Women suffering from chronic insomnia and anxiety. Grandmothers raising their grandchildren because their daughters are too broken to try again. And all of it, every tear, every collapse, every slow death of the spirit, happens in silence. There are no documentaries about them. No statistics that truly measure them. Only a nation of women, drowning slowly beneath a wave of bullets. The mothers who refuse to stay silent. Some, however, are turning their grief into fire. One of the most powerful resistance movements in recent years has been led by mothers of murdered sons. Women like Auntie Jean, who lost both her boys to gang violence, and now runs a weekend trauma circle under a bridge in Eastport of Spain, or Sister Carlene, who organizes candlelight vigils for every child killed in Laventille, sometimes lighting 5 candles in 1 week. These women are not politicians. They are not police. But they are the last line of dignity in a collapsing society. "We have nothing left to fear," Jean says. "They took everything. So now we stand. The psychological toll of survival. Survival in a war zone leaves scars that cannot be stitched. Many women develop hypervigilance syndrome. Unable to rest, always scanning for threats. Some live with complex grief, compounded by the guilt of not doing more, even when they did everything. Others suffer in isolation, blamed by their communities for raising bad boys, as if their wombs were weapons instead of sanctuaries. This emotional pain often never reaches clinics or support services, because in Trinidad's crime zones, mental health is still a taboo. And yet, some find strength in faith, some in activism, and some in simply getting up every morning and feeding a child in a home where laughter used to live. The unseen power of female resilience. The tragedy of this forgotten war is that women carry the weight of loss and the burden of rebuilding. They hold families together, protect children from retaliation, wash blood off the veranda before school starts, sit in courtrooms alone, waiting for a trial that may never come, light candles on birthdays that now mark deaths. They are the beating heart of survival. But survival should not be the ceiling. Survival is not enough. Glimmers of change. Change is slow, but it's stirring. Organizations like Rape Crisis Society, Families in Action, and I Am One offer grief counseling, trauma therapy, and safe houses. Church networks are quietly funding education for children of murdered parents. Some schools are introducing grief education programs, helping children express pain in healthy ways. And there is growing recognition among journalists, social workers, and artists that the story of crime in Trinidad is incomplete without the voice of women. A final image. A mother sits in her kitchen. Her son's face, frozen forever at age 16, smiles from a cracked photo frame on the table. The fridge hums. A Bible lies open, unread. Outside, a car backfires and she flinches. But she does not scream. She's used to the sound. This is her war. And still, she wakes up the next day and fights it again, with love, with sorrow, and with silence. There is a moment, every year, in Trinidad. A sacred contradiction. The streets of Port of Spain erupt with music, color, feathers, paint, and powder, as tens of thousands dance through the capital, lost in the joy of carnival. The drums of soca thunder. The air tastes like sweat and rum. And for a fleeting instant, the island feels alive with pure, boundless freedom. But beneath the euphoric rhythms lies a chilling dissonance. Because in the days leading up to carnival, and often in the days after, there are other sounds. Gunfire echoing off zinc rooftops. Ambulances racing through the outskirts. Mothers clutching shirts soaked in blood instead of juve paint. This is the paradox of modern Trinidad. Carnival in the shadow of violence. The origins of carnival, rebellion dressed as joy. Carnival in Trinidad is more than celebration. It is cultural resistance wrapped in sequins. Its origins trace back to enslaved Africans who, denied participation in European masquerade balls, created their own underground festival, Cambolé, a night of drumming, fire, and masked identity. They used satire, costumes, and music to mock slave owners, mimic colonial rituals, and reclaim their stolen humanity. Even after emancipation, the spirit of carnival remained subversive, a way for the oppressed to laugh at the powerful, to become kings and queens for a day, and to dance through pain. But somewhere along the road, the meaning began to shift. Carnival today, escape or illusion. Modern carnival is a multi-million dollar machine. 8,000 plus masqueraders. Dozens of bands. International tourists. Massive fetes. Non-stop music. It is often sold as the greatest show on earth. And in many ways, it is. But for many locals, especially in Trinidad's most dangerous communities, carnival is both a sanctuary and a trigger. Because as the city celebrates, the ghettos watch. Pre-carnival violence, the hidden season. Every year, in the weeks leading up to carnival, violence spikes. Why? Turf wars flare over control of event security contracts. Gang members seek revenge hits before police increase patrols. Rival blocks clash over carnival routes and street dominance. Personal vendettas play out while the city is distracted. In 2023, police recorded 42 murders in the 3 weeks prior to Carnival Monday, many within a five-mile radius of downtown. Community elders refer to this as the Red Season, not for the costumes, but for the blood. Mosque camps in the crosshairs. Even the spaces that create Carnival, the mosque camps, are no longer immune. Some banned launches have been canceled due to threats. Mosque makers have faced extortion from local gangs demanding payment for protection. And in 2022, two masqueraders were gunned down just hours after Juve, victims of a feud that had nothing to do with the road, but everything to do with where they were from. This has caused a growing number of young people to abandon traditional mosques, fearing not the exhaustion of dancing for hours, but the real threat of becoming a target. Police, militarization, and the joy killers. To ensure safety during Carnival, the state deploys hundreds of armed officers, soldiers, drones, and CCTV cameras. Checkpoints are set, bags are searched, and some zones become militarized. While this helps prevent some violence, it also changes the energy. The presence of uniformed men with rifles, stationed beside costumed women in beaded bras, creates a surreal tension. A nation dancing, under surveillance. And the communities most policed during Carnival? The same ones left alone the rest of the year. They come out for Carnival, says Kenya, a 24-year-old from Belmont. But where are they when the shootings start in April? Carnival is resistance. The music fights back. Still, even now, Carnival remains an act of spiritual defiance. In every road march, every Moko Jumbi, every iron drum, there is a whisper. You did not break us. Artists like Kes, Nayla Blackman, and Voice increasingly use their platforms to address pain beneath the rhythm. Songs once purely celebratory now carry undertones of reflection, survival, and national reckoning. One 2023 Juve chant went viral for its stark honesty. We partying now, because we don't know tomorrow. The women who dance with grief. Many of the women on the Carnival Road have buried a child, a brother, or a lover. They don their costumes, paint their faces, and dance for those who can't. Their joy is not naive, it is revolutionary. One Moss player, Simone, lost her son to gang violence. But she plays Moss every year in his name. They want us to mourn forever. But I refuse. I go on the road with his picture in my heart. That's how I fight. In this way, Carnival becomes a battlefield, not one of bullets, but of memory, dignity, and cultural pride. Can Carnival heal a nation? Perhaps not completely, but it reminds the people, even for 2 days, of who they are beyond their pain. Children throw powder on each other instead of punches. Strangers dance in unity instead of suspicion. The same streets that host murders become stages for art. For a moment, laughter competes with gunfire, and sometimes laughter wins. The face of Trinidad's violence is often young. Too young. The trigger puller is not a war-hardened soldier, but a boy in his school shoes. The lookout is not a battle-trained scout, but a girl who still braids dolls at home. And the silence that blankets communities is not always fear of death. Sometimes, it's the ache of knowing that the killers used to sit in your living room. In this chapter, we go inside the minds of the young and the restless. The boys and girls caught in a system that shaped them into soldiers before they ever had a chance to dream. A generation born in crisis. Over 60% of Trinidad's homicide suspects and victims are under the age of 30. More than half of them had dropped out of school before reaching age 16. Many never knew a father. Some never knew stability. But they all knew this. If they wanted respect in the ghetto, they had to earn it with fear. The making of a shooter. We met Javen, not his real name, a 17-year-old from C. Lots, serving time in juvenile detention. He spoke plainly. I didn't join a gang to kill. I joined to belong. Nobody else wanted me. They made me feel like a man. He described his initiation. A beating to test his endurance. A robbery to prove his courage. A final act, pulling the trigger on a rival, a boy his own age, from two streets over. He didn't flinch. Because by then, he had already lost himself. School to block. A pipeline of failure. Trinidad's inner-city schools are often the first places young boys are marked as dangerous. Overcrowded classrooms. Underpaid teachers. No counselors. Frequent absenteeism. Zero mental health support. Boys with trauma are labeled as problem children instead of being offered therapy or mentorship. Eventually, they stop showing up, and the streets catch them on the fall. Masculinity and violence, a deadly performance. In the communities most plagued by crime, masculinity is not measured by compassion or wisdom, but but by dominance. A real man doesn't cry, doesn't back down, doesn't trust anyone, carries a weapon, has enemies, has a crew, has a reputation. Young men in this ecosystem are not just reacting. They are performing a version of manhood forged in poverty, trauma, and media. And in this role, failure means death. Social media, the new battlefield. Instagram lives, WhatsApp threats, TikTok diss tracks, Facebook callouts. In Trinidad, gang rivalries now play out digitally before they erupt on the street. A photo with a certain hand sign, a video disrespecting a dead rival, a lyric calling out a block by name. These posts are more than clout, they are coded declarations of war, often leading to blood within hours. Young gang members use social media to recruit, threaten, mourn, track police, broadcast proof of power. You see the man before he dead, says one youth worker. You see him livestream the threat. You see the reaction. Then the news report. It's a movie, with no credits. Just coffins. Why they stay? We often ask why these boys don't leave. Why they don't run. Why they don't choose peace. But the answer is complex. Fear of betrayal. Leaving a gang is seen as treason, and is often punishable by death. Lack of alternatives. Many are unemployable due to criminal records or address stigma. Survivor's guilt. Some feel obligated to avenge fallen friends. Economic need. The block pays, even if it costs your soul. No trust in the system. Police protection is a fantasy. Court justice is a joke. One boy put it best. The gang will kill me if I leave, but the world don't care if I stay. So either way, I'm on my own. Girls in the crossfire. Girls are often overlooked until it's too late. Some are used as lures or lookouts. Others become sexual currency between gangs. Many suffer in silence, watching their brothers die, their homes raided, and their futures shrink. Some rise into leadership. Some get out. Most just try to survive without disappearing. Breaking the cycle. Can redemption happen? Yes, but it takes a radical shift. Across Trinidad, some youth programs are seeing success. The Heroes Foundation uses creative arts and storytelling to rehabilitate at-risk youth. Vision on Mission provides reintegration support for former gang members. Hearts and Minds program brings police and youth together for dialogue and trust building. Pan in the Classroom uses Steel Pan to give kids structure, rhythm, and hope. But the scale is small, the funding is fragile, and the time is running out. A letter never sent. At the end of our conversation with Javen, he gave us a letter. It was addressed to his little brother. He asked us to read it. Liam, if you ever feel like doing what I did, stop. Don't follow me. I thought I was protecting you, but I made you next in line. I don't want you to be next. Stay home. Read books. Play Pan. Remember me only as your brother. Not a killer. After all the sirens fade. After the news reports move on. After the bullet shells are swept away and the carnival costumes are boxed in silence. The question still stands, trembling at the center of this nation's soul. Can Trinidad and Tobago heal? Can a country that has buried so many of its sons, imprisoned its future, and broken its promises, still find a way back from the edge? This is the final chapter of our story. Not a conclusion, but a call. A confrontation with the truth, and a glimpse of what might still be possible. What healing looks like. Healing isn't a press conference. It's not a new commissioner, a shiny billboard, or a headline that says, crime down. Healing is slower, deeper, and far more painful. It begins in homes, in schools, in police stations, in parliament, and in every place where the human cost of violence is finally acknowledged, not as a statistic, but as a wound. And the good news? It's already happening. Quietly, relentlessly, in pockets, in defiance. The community rebuilders. In the hills of Gonzales, a retired teacher named Miss Charmaine runs a weekend literacy camp for boys at risk of gang recruitment. She's buried two nephews. But every Saturday, she bakes coconut bread and opens her doors. I can't save the world, but maybe I can save two. In Enterprise, a Muslim youth group teaches martial arts, discipline, and Quranic values to children who once watched shootouts from their verandas. In Diego Martin, a father who lost his daughter to a stray bullet started a mentoring program called Backpack, Not Bulletproof. These are not government programs. They are acts of grassroots resistance, a quiet revolution. Education as a weapon of peace. Trinidad schools have long been neglected, but a few innovative educators are fighting back. Pan in the Classroom brings SteelPan into the school system, giving students structure, pride, and a cultural identity rooted in creativity, not crime. iConnect TT teaches coding and entrepreneurship in underserved schools, helping youth envision futures outside of poverty. Restorative justice practices are being introduced in some classrooms, focusing on healing and accountability over punishment. A teacher in Morvant told us, "We can't just teach math. We have to teach how to live without killing. Police reform, the long road. There are brave officers, men and women in uniform who risk their lives not for power, but for peace. Some have started community policing units, building trust block by block. Others mentor children in crime-prone neighborhoods, trying to rewrite the image of the badge. But the system still bleeds, with corruption, underfunding, and politicization. True reform will take years of consistent pressure, independent oversight, and cultural change from the top down. Still, individual officers are choosing integrity. And in a country this battered, that alone is revolutionary. Art, music, and cultural renaissance. The culture that once gave the world Calypso, Soca, and SteelPan is rising again, this time with a message of resistance and rebirth. Artists are using music and poetry to name the violence, mourn the dead, and challenge the silence. Soca artists now sing not just of wine and jam, but of survival and spirit. Spoken word poetry slams echo in school halls with lines like, "I'm more than a zip code. I'm more than a gang map. I'm more than a body that fits inside a chalk line." Filmmakers and podcasters are documenting the trauma, the resilience, and the truth. Culture is no longer just carnival. It is consciousness, the role of diaspora and global pressure. Trinidadians abroad, from London to Toronto to Brooklyn, are raising their voices. Some are funding community centers back home. Others are writing letters to embassies, launching online campaigns, or creating digital platforms to amplify grassroots organizers on the ground. The diaspora matters, because it offers both visibility and accountability. It reminds the nation, the world is watching, the power of memory and memorialization. Healing also requires remembering. A proposal has emerged, led by youth activists, to build a national memorial for victims of violence. A space where every name is etched, where families can grieve, where the country can finally look itself in the eye. Because what we do not mourn, we repeat. And what we do not face, we cannot fix. What needs to happen now? Healing is possible, but only if the following truths are accepted. You cannot police your way out of a crisis you neglected into being. You cannot preach patriotism to people you abandoned. You cannot save a country until you value every life equally, no matter their address, no matter their history, no matter how small their name. The path forward includes justice system reform, gun control and border surveillance, community investment, mental health services, employment pipelines, youth leadership, a new national story, a story where resilience replaces revenge, where grief becomes gospel, where carnival is not a distraction from death, but a declaration of life. Final reflection. So can Trinidad and Tobago heal? Yes, but it will take every voice, the mother, the youth, the teacher, the police officer, the artist, the politician, and the man who once pulled a trigger and now pulls up a child from falling. Healing is not a miracle. It is a choice, made every day, by people who refuse to let their country be defined by violence alone. As the sun rises over Port of Spain, the city exhales. And somewhere, in a quiet corner, a child is laughing again. That alone is worth everything.